Thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff for the Atlas Society with TAS Senior Fellow Rob Trzynski discussing the Genghis Khan problem. And Rob, thanks for being here today. It's a good title. I'll have the sound of music. How do you solve a problem like Genghis Khan?
That really has nothing to do with Sound of Music. All right, so I don't really know where to go with that, so I'm just gonna ignore that part. But so this actually came out of our previous Clubhouse discussion that we had, where somebody said, I was making the case for a morality of self-interest, and somebody said, well, if you have morality of self-interest, where self-interest is the goal, why wouldn't Genghis Khan be your ultimate example of a guy who pursued his self-interest? And I gave an answer there, but I thought, you know, this is a really interesting question. There's variations of this we've always had to deal with. I thought it sort of deserved its own full discussion. So why isn't Genghis Khan an example of self-interest? Now, I'm going to make a case for him being, you know, why you would think, people might think he is an example of self-interest. And that is that, you know, he, after banding together the various Mongol tribes and creating an irresistibly powerful military force, he conquered this vast area, and he lived in incredible luxury for the rest of his life, and enjoying all the very best that was available to anyone in the, you know, 13th century in Mongolia, in Central Asia. Beautiful women, captive slaves brought to him as concubines, all of the best food, the best of everything you could possibly have, because he was the great Khan, the Genghis Khan. And he was, you know, he was the guy in charge of everything, and he could command these thousands of warriors and all the plunder and loot from all the various tribes that the other people that they defeated. So why wouldn't he be an example of self-interest? He lived the best kind of life materially that anyone could possibly have lived at that time and in that place. All right, so there's the general question put forward. And the wider point of this, the reason people bring this up, is the idea of why isn't force and exploitation an example of self-interest, right? So why wouldn't, you know, the modern equivalent of this would be, why not rob banks, right? Because that's where the money is. So if your goal is self-interest, and self-interest means, you know, requires material means to have all sorts of nice things, why wouldn't you then go become a bank robber and get millions of dollars robbing banks? By the way, people who rob banks don't generally come away with millions of dollars, but that's, we'll talk about that later. But why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you be a bank robber? Why wouldn't you be a con man, a swindler? Why wouldn't you do some way in which you're using force and exploitation in order to wring money and resources and value out of other people? So why would that not be an example of self-interest? All right. So this, by the way, the reason why I bring this up is that this is the radical thing about Ayn Rand's moral philosophy. So what's radical about it is not so much that she advocated self-interest, but what she thought self-interest consisted of. So, you know, her great examples of heroes of self-interest were not Genghis Khan. They were not exploiters. They were not bank robbers. They were not even financial manipulators, with one small exception, the short story she did. But they were, generally speaking, they were inventors. They were creators. They were builders. They were people who were not exploiting others, but people who were creating things. So, you know, an engineer, an inventor, a physicist and an inventor is one of her heroes, or an architect is one of her heroes, or, you know, an executive who runs a railroad, and not just runs a railroad in the sense of sitting in the boardroom and making financial decisions, but who actually runs the operational end of the railroad, the person who makes sure that, literally makes sure that the trains run on time, right? So the people that she championed as heroes of self-interest were people who have gotten to do things and create things, and in a very clear and obvious way, as the way she presents it, they provide enormous value in exchange for for the money that they get, for the wealth and the money and the values that they gain out of their work. So, you know, her heroes are traders, people who trade value for value. So that's what's radical about, in a way, about her moral philosophy, is not that she advocated self-interest, but that she did not regard Genghis Khan, the person who used force, uses force or exploitation, as an example of self-interest. So we have to ask then, so what's wrong with this Genghis Khan view? How do we solve this Genghis Khan problem? Why would he not be an example of self-interest? Now, I would also mention, we're talking about rational self-interest here. You know, this is a key part of Ayn Rand's philosophy. Is it's not just self-interest, it's rational self-interest. Now, you could argue rational self-interest is a redundancy because, you know, rational self-interest means stuff that's actually in your self-interest as opposed to something that momentarily appears to be in your self-interest but is actually bad for you, right? So, you know, if you do something pleasurable that is going to be self-destructive, that would be an example of something that you're carried away by the immediate impulse of thinking, oh, I would enjoy this, but you're ignoring the bad long-term consequences. So it's something that's not actually in your self-interest. So it's a redundancy, but it's a useful redundancy because it's there to remind us that you actually have to go through a process of thinking, a process of calculation, and say, what's going to be the long-term consequences of this thing? This thing might feel good at the moment that, you know, having another drink might feel good at the moment I'm doing it, but then I get behind the wheel of my car and I get in an accident and I get myself killed, right? So, you know, it's something that is pleasant at the moment you're doing it, but has a destructive consequence or a potential destructive consequence, you know, in the next moment or in the moment after that. All right, so it's a useful redundancy to say rational self-interest. So why is Genghis Khan not an example of rational self-interest? All right, so one of the things I did, I actually did a little brief looking up on the actual history of Genghis Khan as a real person, you know, because we can say, oh, well, Genghis Khan, he had it all great. You know, he was the ruler of like, you know, a quarter of Asia and had all the things, all the servant girls and the food and the wine and what have you. And you could say he seemed to have a really great life, but you have to look at his life in the whole context. And one of the things that jumped out in looking at his history is the immense insecurity of life in the time that he lived. So Temujin is the actual name. His actual real name was Temujin. And then he became the Khan, and then he became the Chinggis Khan or the Genghis Khan, which is like the Great Khan, the Grand Khan. The Khan means roughly king or tribal leader, and the Great Khan is the tribal leader of who unites this large number of tribes, which is his big achievement, was uniting all the different Mongol and Mongol-related tribes of Central Asia. All right, but before that, this is something he did later in his life. But before that, in his youth, he had a life of tremendous insecurity. I think his father died and his mother was like not cared for or cast out by the tribe that they were part of. And he lived in incredible poverty and basically on the brink of starvation during his youth because, you know, Mongolia, Central Asia in the Middle Ages was an extremely rough place. And part of the reason, you have to think, part of the reason why he had this sort of tyrannical empire he built is it was precisely in reaction to the tremendous insecurity of the society in which he lived, that he, you know, you had to basically, the time, the rule of that time was kill or be killed, rule or be ruled, have control and power over other people or else they'll kill you. And that's a lesson he learned very early on in his life, the tremendous insecurity and danger that he lived in. And furthermore, there were various people, and I don't have this all written down, but there were various people who served as sort of partners and allies and supporters of his that ended up along the way getting killed, or in some cases he killed them because he, you know, there were friends and allies who became rivals, and so he killed them. And so he's sort of like the last guy standing out of a whole group of people who are friends and allies who were part of this project with him, many of whom did not survive. So that's the next thing we're going to say. So first of all, the first thing we're going to say about what's wrong with this as a model of rational self-interest is that it comes out of a context of a society in which achieving your self-interest is very, very hard to do. It's an extremely violent, insecure, dangerous society. And so, you know, the idea is that, yes, maybe you'll become the great Khan and you'll be able to have all the great things. You'll be the guy killing your enemies and your enemies won't be killing you. But the chances of getting there, the chances are much higher that you're going to be one of the guys who's killed by one of the other people, right? So this is, as a society, as a way of life, the chances are much greater for you that you are not going to become the great Khan, that you are going to become one of the guys who ends up as roadkill along the way. And by the way, as roadkill, I mean, I was doing my research here, I found things like one guy won a battle and took a bunch of the enemy warriors and had them boiled alive in vats. The other thing was something called a common practice at the time called measuring against the linchpin. And this is the idea that the linchpin is like the central pin where the axle was on a very, very high cart for carrying supplies for the army. And the idea is when you conquered a rival tribe and you defeated them, you would have all their warriors walk past the wheel, and anyone who was taller than the linchpin would be executed. And this is the idea that, you know, you don't kill everybody in the defeated tribe. What you do is all the oldest and strongest guys, the biggest and strongest and oldest, and which tends to correlate to the oldest ones, they all get executed because they're the most dangerous to you. And the younger ones who can be sort of absorbed then as servants within your tribe, they get to live. So, you know, this tremendously dangerous time period tremendously dangerous culture and society he lived in which you are way, way, way more likely to end up getting killed or to be a slave or to be miserable in some very obvious way rather than ending up as, you know, one of the guys in power. So that's the next thing I want to go to, is that, you know, the thing about Genghis Khan is there's only one Genghis Khan, right? There's only one guy who gets to be in that position, and 99.99999% of the population is not that guy, right? So it's self-interest for one person. If you accept this as a model of self-interest, it would be a model that is unavailable to 99.99999% of the population in whatever area that is. Now, let's say we could say, okay, well, there's an elite in Mongolian society. Some of the top guys, although, you know, if you're even wanting for one of the top guys, if Genghis Khan decides, you know, you need to be tortured to death or killed, you're in trouble. But let's say, you know, there's an elite. There's the 99% and there's the 1% of Mongolian society who have a pretty good life. They're in charge. They're the ones giving orders to everybody else. It's still the fact that, you know, as a general rule for how to live, most people aren't, you know, this model of self-interest, if it were a model of self-interest, would be utterly unavailable to most of the people in that society. So you couldn't say, oh, well, this is a moral rule for people to follow, because most people would not, in fact, be able to follow it. They'd end up being, you know, the slaves and the servants and the hoi polloi. So, then I also want to put out one other thing before I get to the main thing, which is also, if you are Genghis Khan and you are able to have everything you want, notice that this implies a very limited view of what is in your interest and what is pleasurable in life, right? So Genghis Khan is able to get the very best life that's available to somebody in the 1200s in Central Asia, which is extremely limited version of the good life compared to everything else that we know is possible. It's a very materialistic, very physicalistic viewpoint, but even materially it's limited, right? So you get the very best food and plenty of it. You get beautiful women to have as concubines. Or if you really like them as wives, you know, if they're conquered princesses, you might have them as one of your many wives. And you get there's actually a quote about what he promises men, is that the finest tents that are like palaces. So you get a really great, beautiful yurt to live in. Okay, so you get food, and you get a yurt to live in, and you get women to sleep with. All right, so it's basically, but it's this very materialistic sort of view of what self-interest is. It's basically sex, food, and a soft bed to lie in. And notice that there's a lot of other things, a lot of other pleasures, a lot, even material, even on a purely material level, a lot of other pleasures that are not available to you. So Genghis kind of looked this up. He lived to be fairly old. He lived to be in his 70s. But again, that's just, you know, we know about Genghis Khan because he was the lucky guy, right? Because at that time, the and that place, the life expectancy was much, much lower than that. It was probably more like in the 40s or 50s. Probably, I'd probably guess at that time in that place, your life expectancy would be like 42 years old, somewhere in there, right? So the fact that, you know, on a material level, the fact that he lived to be in his 70s is because he was an unusual and exceptional person. And that's part of the reason why we know his name, right? Because he lived long enough to become a king for a long period of time and have all this power. You know, even if he didn't die in battle, the more common thing, and actually one of the speculations is that of how he died in battle is it was an infection from a wound, or how he died, excuse me. He didn't die in battle, but he died after the battle. But one of the speculations, nobody really knows for sure, is that based on the accounts of at the time, is that he died from an infection from a wound. Well, he died, in other words, from something that you would not die of today in a modern advanced society. We'd have better medical care. We'd have everything that he had would be better than today than for the average, for even for the average person, even for a poor person today, has all sorts of things that are materially better than anything Genghis that was available, you know, to the great chieftain in Mongolia in the 13th century. Now, why is it that we have then now, you know, and that's not even taking into account all the things spiritually that we have that are better. I mean, you know, you have access to more interesting music, greater variety and amount of art and quality of art. There's all sorts of non-material pleasures, spiritual pleasures that are available to you that, I mean, you know, Genghis Khan was almost certainly illiterate. So, you know, he didn't sit down and read a good book at the end of the night because he couldn't read. And so there are all sorts of pleasures that are not purely physical pleasures that were also not available to him. Now, why is it that in a modern society we have all these physical material advancements? We live longer, we live more comfortably, enjoy sort of a greater degree of luxury than, in a purely material sense, than somebody like Genghis Khan would have lived. But we also have available to us all these non-material, all these spiritual values that we are capable of enjoying if we pursue them. So why is it that we have all these things? Well, we have all these things precisely because we live in a more advanced society that's made possible by people not living like Genghis Khan, right? It's because we had a society in which we said, well, look, maybe if we all stopped trying to kill each other, if we didn't enslave people, you know, if we didn't view people purely to be conquered and exploited, if we worked together by cooperation and mutual self-interest in a society, you know, characterized by production and trade, then we could produce more and we could have, you know, so much more available to the average person, to universally to everyone. We could have so much more available to us and so much more possible to us than we would in under previous conditions. And we were right about that. That was, you know, that this was the idea adopted sort of slowly, but eventually, especially in the Enlightenment, this is the ideal, is that we'd have a peaceful society of people living together by mutual trade, and that would make us all better off. And it succeeded beyond the wildest dreams of the people in the Enlightenment. So, and we had the Industrial Revolution, we had all these huge advances. We're better, you know, not just the elite, the top people, the wealthiest people, but practically everyone in our society is better off both materially and spiritually in terms of the pleasures that are available to them to enjoy, that are within their reach to enjoy, than Genghis Khan would have been. And we got that way because of the fact that we adopted a totally different rule. Rather than force and exploitation, we adopted, you know, mutual trade and production as the moral basis of our society, right? So that leads me to the last, the final thing to say about the sort of solution to the Genghis problem, Khan problem, which is it fundamentally misunderstands what kind of society Genghis Khan lived in. Genghis Khan did not live in a society in which self-interest was the ideal. He lived in a society in which tribalism was the ideal, in which service to your family or to your tribe or to the king or to, you know, to the Khan, that was the ideal, right? So he lived in a society, and you could think of it, his society he lived in would not work if self-interest was its openly declared, widely adopted moral philosophy, because people would stop sacrificing themselves for the great Khan, right? They would not agree to be cannon fodder in his armies. They would not agree to be his slaves. He'd be basically dealing with constant rebellion that people are saying, well, why can't I pursue my self-interest too? Right. So the societies in which you have a great exploiter who's able to, use force and conquest to keep everybody else down, those societies, if you actually look at what those societies consist of, they almost always, they always rely on some form of altruism or sacrifice as the basis of their morality, because that's what makes the conqueror and the exploiter possible. You know, other people have to be willing to sacrifice themselves in order for him to be the recipient of those sacrifices. If everybody else was out there trying to say, I think we should all pursue our self-interest, his rule would become untenable. Let's put it that way. They would not cooperate in the system that he created. All right. So I think the final answer to this is that, I said that Genghis Khan, he's like 0.00001% of the population. So, his form, if what he represents is self-interest, well, it's not available to most everybody. But more fundamentally is that the kind of society that makes Genghis Khan possible is one that does not preach self-interest to 99.99% of the population. It preaches sacrifice and, subservience as its moral ideal to those people, whether it's subservience to the tribe, to the family, subservience to your master as a slave, etc. So it fundamentally, that gives us, I think, our deepest answer as to why this is not an example of self-interest, because self-interest is not, we're talking about moral philosophy. It is a moral philosophy of self-interest, and it's something that's universal and applies to everybody. There is no such moral philosophy as I can pursue my interests and nobody else can. The minute you declare something to be a philosophical principle, it applies universally to anyone. There's no, I guess the proper term for it probably would be special pleading, right? There's no special pleading in philosophy. No saying, well, this is the rule for me, but it shouldn't apply to anybody else. So the minute you say, if you said exploitation, this exploitative view of self-interest was a moral philosophy, you would be basically saying, well, therefore nobody else should accept me as the ruler, as the leader, as there's no reason I could give for anybody to accept me as the ruler or the leader. And you'd actually unleash what anarchy, a war of all against all. All right. So this is, if we think about self-interest as a philosophy, right, you cannot have as a philosophy, as a principle, self-interest does not lead to this system of exploitation and rule by a great, powerful conqueror and chieftain. All right, so I think I've said enough. I think it's time to open it up for discussion and questions and comments and anything else anybody wants to say.
Great. And I want to encourage people to raise your hand if you want to be part of the discussion. We have TAS founder David Kelly. I didn't know if you had a question before we open it up to either myself or the audience.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. That was great. And I have had a kind of a weird fascination with Genghis Khan. I've read a couple of books, including several by a guy who's sort of a defender in a way, or trying to make the best case, named Jack Weatherford. one book is called Genghis Khan, The Making of the Modern World. I don't know if you've seen that. But anyway, what you're saying is absolutely true. Genghis Khan, whatever wealth he gained by the standards of his time, was the result of, zero-sum transactions or negative-sum transactions, mainly. He killed something somewhere between 10 and 50 million people, he and his hordes. And that was a significant part of the world population. He wiped out the Islamic culture, which at the time was the most advanced civilization on Earth. He built those cities. He just appropriated technology to use for war from everyone, the Chinese and others who had developed it. On the other hand, one of the aftermaths was when the Khans ruled from, the borders of Europe all the way through China under Kublai, the Silk Road became a safe transit point for trade. This is one of the weird things about history, that just kinds of things you wouldn't expect, that a predator like Genghis Khan would, and the brutality and the, the devastation he wrought would lead to something that actually was a really, at the time, a hugely important transit for trade opportunity across. You could travel the Silk Road, and the bandits, the raiders, were all controlled by the Khans. So it's just weird. I think history is has an awful lot of surprises here. But the, I don't have so much as of a question as a comment.
No, I think that's fascinating, David. I have something to say about that, but go ahead.
Okay, well, maybe I should stop there, because that's really all I had to say. Except that the question you're raising, the philosophical question, the Genghis Khan, he's the emblem of what's been called the prudent predator issue in libertarian thought, critic of objectivism. And I always have to laugh, because most of the people who make that argument are, kind of intellectual types, long hair, Birkenstocks. They would last about 5 minutes in Genghis Khan's world.
Well, maybe that's why your point. They want to use that as an argument against self-interest, because, like, God forbid we should live in a world like that. I wouldn't make it. One of my points, though, is that very few people would make it, and very few people did actually survive in Genghis Khan's world. It was a rough place. But I want to talk about this idea of him as a great unifier, because that is one thing that does happen, is that oftentimes you have a brutal conqueror, but he becomes then a unifier and unifies a great empire, and actually, to some extent, decreases the amount of warfare. It's similar to the stationary bandit idea, right? So one of the ideas for how government came to be, there's the social contract is how government came to be. But some people have pointed out, well, actually, historically, the more common way for the government to come into existence is the stationary bandit, right? So you have a farm and you create something, and then a bandit comes along and steals it, and then he goes away. Well, you'd be better off if you have your little town in Mesopotamia, 5,000 years ago, you would be way better off having a stationary bandit, a guy who, sure, he's there to rob and exploit you, but he stays there and he lives in your city, and he has an interest, therefore, in making sure you don't get killed too much, and in making sure you don't get robbed too often. He'll take a little cut of everything out of your thing, but it'll be predictable, and he'll have an interest in having you still be able to flourish and survive. And so the stationary bandit is better than the bandit that strikes and leaves. And so therefore, that this is how government comes into being. So oftentimes you have a ruthless exploiter and a murderer, mass murderer like this, who ends up unifying. So one of the things Genghis Khan did, the thing that made him Genghis Khan, the great Khan, is he was in this area of the world, Central Asia, where the general rule was all the tribes were killing each other all the time. All these little tribes of, you know, a thousand or 2,000 people, your tribe would go murder the people in the tribe next to you. And he basically managed to convince a bunch of these tribes and say, well, look, if we stop murdering each other and we all got together and worked together and we got like 50,000 of us, we could go off and murder other people somewhere else.
Yeah.
And be irresistible because nobody else has, you know, nobody else has these enormous numbers that we have. And that's basically how he achieved his conquest. One of the things, by the way, he did is he would, when he defeated a tribe, he would not kill everybody in the tribe. He would absorb them. And then, so therefore his army became bigger. And so he basically said, you know, we're going to unify all together and then we can go kill more other people. But in that role of Genghis Khan as unifier, one of the things I want to point out though, is the contrast between that and another great example of that, which is the Roman Empire. Or I wouldn't say the Roman Empire, but the Roman Republic, right? Even before they became an empire, what made Rome great, the rise of Rome as a republic, was the fact that they forged relationships with all of it. They unified Italy. They forged relationships with all the other different tribes in Italy and were able to sort of put together this large area that they controlled where they all worked together and they had this big irresistible army and they were able to defeat the Carthaginians and defeat this people and those people. But they did it on the basis of far more benevolent rules than Genghis Khan had. And also they did it while then being able to create more material advancement and more cultural advancement. You know, one of the things that fascinates me about Genghis Khan and the Mongols is there's a number of different people like this in the ancient world where you hear about them and we have some archaeological evidence of them and they ruled and conquered often very large areas. But after that, they disappear, right? They essentially leave no trace. They leave no trace culturally because they were able to conquer or rule a large area, but they didn't create art, distinctive art. They didn't create distinctive literature. Now, in some cases, maybe it's just they did and they didn't survive. But in the case of the Mongols, we know pretty much they didn't create anything. They didn't create anything that had a major impact. And so oftentimes what happens is these conquerors then themselves sort of get conquered culturally. So, for example, in India, the successors of the Khans of the Mongols were the Mughal Empire, and the Mughal Empire basically becomes religiously and culturally Indian, right? So it gets absorbed into the native culture that they conquered because they had no distinctive cultural achievements or creations of their own. And that's a very common thing that comes from this. So I would say that, you know, the much more interesting example of there are people who unified a society and made trade across large distances possible, such as in the Roman Empire, but they did it under rules that made a much greater degree of flourishing possible, that made a great deal of more cultural advance possible. Now, the Romans were no angels. They had, you know, they had slavery practiced on a very large scale. although I would point out, Genghis Khan is, from my knowledge, you might know more about this, David. David might know more about this, but Genghis Khan is, I understand the Mongols didn't really take slaves. They came in and they killed everybody, and they took the stuff. Right? They didn't take the people, they took the stuff. And that's why they had such a high body count in terms of how many people they killed. They were not interested in taking slaves and managing slaves. It's a real headache. So they would go in and they would just go and take stuff. And so because they were so purely materially focused, that's part of the reasons why they left this great swath of destruction, but didn't really leave any cultural impact.
No, that's true. China under Kublai Khan may be a partial exception, but you know, I think you're right. And but I love the idea. I hadn't heard that concept of the stationary bandit before. It's great, and kind of an early form of supply side economics. the less you tax, the more you get.
Exactly.
Anyway, I'll leave it there. Thank you, Rob.
Great. Thanks again. If anyone wants to join us, please raise your hand. We'll bring you up to the stage. You know, I've studied him a little bit as well. I'm a huge fan of his General Subutai. And I think he you know, is an example of kind of blind, unchecked ambition, because he went from just, you know, having nothing to just, you know, just continuing to conquer as much as he could. And that, you know, attitude exists out there. I mean, when you start to get into, you know, the age of exploration, or, you know, you've got where these people are saying that, you know, what we saw as exploration, they see as just like being Genghis Khan.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting question, because the real Genghis Khan problem, actually, when you think about it, is you see this as a stage of development most societies have to go through, is coming up with some way in which you can have winners and losers without it being winner take all, right? So that's not as articulate a formulation as I would like. But so there's, for example, one of the things that you tended to see in the Greek city-states, in ancient Greece with the Greek city-states, one of the things you tended to see was that they were constantly battling against it. They were constantly at war with each other. And one of the reasons is that anytime one of them became strong, their approach basically would be to dominate and exploit and attack and kill their neighbors, right? And so they had no way they could band together and cooperate. And that's why they're always at war with each other, because there was no concept of winning except I'm now the guy who gets to kill and loot with abandon. There's no concept of winning except total domination. And so one of the advances that you had to have culturally was the idea of how can we create a society in which the strongest guy, you know, the guy who emerges as the strongest doesn't immediately then destroy everybody else. How do we create a system in which people can actually cooperate together and work together, and as a result of cooperating and working together, are able to do much more and create much more than they would otherwise? So I think the real Genghis Khan problem is how do you go beyond that primitive concept of self-interest, where it's purely material and it's done by conquest and domination of your neighbors, to, if dare I say, an enlightened concept of self-interest. I mean, this is the original formulation for a morality of self-interest was enlightened self-interest, or self-interest properly understood. But I like enlightened self-interest because, you know, it ties into the whole themes of the Enlightenment. But the idea that there is a more elevated, deeper, more valid concept of self-interest that's not the primitive, brutal one of Genghis Khan, but there's one that says, look, we can all pursue our self-interest working together cooperatively by having the society where we have individual rights and where, you know, disputes are adjudicated by a neutral, unbiased government. And we have ways of controlling the government to make sure it doesn't abuse its power. And it takes thousands of years to do this, to start this process and go through it. A whole discussion of it would take hours to discuss exactly what the stages were, but basically stage by stage, taking little baby steps at a time, we got to the point of developing this idea of a kind of society in which you can have competition and you can have ambition and you can have people wanting to make something of themselves and become rich and have the beautiful women and the nice houses and the palaces and all that, and do it without everybody killing each other, and actually with people competing for how much they're going to create and how much they're going to produce, right? This is the real solution to the problem, is you have to have that concept of how a society can work, and it took thousands of years for us to develop it.
Yeah, I was going to say, how much could he have been expected to understand?
Genghis Khan was a man of his time. Let's put it that way. He was a smarter, tougher guy than anybody else around him, right? Because he was able to unite all the tribes and, you know, put down the various palace intrigues and revolts. He was a smarter and more resourceful fellow than everybody else around him. But he was totally a man of his time. And the point is to appreciate how brutal and primitive that time was, and how much worse we would be off. You know, even if you're one of the guys at the top of the system, how much worse you would be off, how much worse off you would be, excuse me, living under that kind of society and under that kind of way of life than you are living under enlightened self-interest, which is essentially the system we have now, even though nobody wants to embrace it and defend it as such.
Yeah, you talk about the, why be a con man in the same way. When I heard that, I was thinking, well, does that calculation change for people at all when they witness blatant public corruption?
Well, yeah, because, most of the time we're the victims of the con men are in Washington, D.C., and we're the marks.
Right.
And that's the thing is, the arrogance of that is always that... I think about in the modern concept of this is why not be a bank robber? Well, the thing is that if you lived in a society characterized by, the bank robber has to always hope that he's a tiny exception in a society, right? So he always has to hope that, all the rest of you people will go out and you'll work and you'll be the suckers who will work 9 to 5 and you'll have your day jobs and you'll make your money, you'll make money and you'll produce stuff and you'll put it into the bank to keep it safe. So that it could be waiting there for me to take. And then once I take it, I can live in a society that's orderly enough that it won't immediately be taken from me by somebody else, right? So the bank robber, the criminal, always implicitly has to rely on himself being a tiny, fractional exception amid the general rule of people not robbing banks and not... killing each other and not robbing each other and not shooting each other, etc. So the bank robber relies on law and order as much as anybody else, right? Because for the peaceful enjoyment of his hard won loot.
For the money to be collected there and for them not to be too rough, even if he gets caught, I guess.
Well, and basically for the money to be there in the first place, and for him not to immediately get robbed and killed by somebody who's stronger than him.
While they're accusing us of being the Genghis Khan or the con man or the bank robber, in fact, I read recently that Stalin robbed a bank in pre-revolutionary Russia. just that was his way of taking from the system and destroying it. But that's what that philosophy leads to.
Well, actually, I think that's a really interesting point because let me just take a few minutes to expand on that, which is that the Genghis Khan thing is usually brought up as an objection to self-interest as a moral philosophy. But when we see altruism instituted on a large scale as a moral philosophy, as the philosophy behind a whole society, what we invariably see is a Genghis Khan-like guy ends up at the top of the system, right? And so that goes back to my point about how Genghis Khan had to rely on people, on everybody else not having a concept of rational self-interest. He had to rely on everybody else not thinking, well, we have rights that you have to respect. He had to rely on sacrifice for the sake of the family or the tribe, sacrifice for the sake of glory in battle or whatever. He had to rely on all of that as being the actual, as being the operational rule that people lived on and not on self-interest. And so the flip side of that is when you have society that's very clearly organized around self-sacrifice, the sacrifice of the individual for the collective greater good, inevitably they end up going to the hands, not of some, saint of self-sacrifice, but they end up going into the hands of the exploiter. Because what do you have? You have a whole group of people willing to sacrifice their own interests, and a guy like Stalin comes along and says, great, they could all be my slaves. And that's essentially, Stalin was a brute. He was not, you can always, this question I think was always very interesting of like, was he idealistically committed to communism, or was he just a brute? Or did he find some synthesis of that? And I think he found some synthesis of that. But he was in his soul, he was a Genghis Khan. And so he shows what actually happens in when you have a society that's self-consciously, deliberately built, very carefully built around a very self-conscious, extremely consistent altruist philosophy. Because, you know, communism was altruism distilled to its essence. You are nothing. You know, the collective good is everything. When you do that, you actually end up enabling and empowering and putting into power the Genghis Khans.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, we do hear people say as one of their criticisms of capitalism, going back to the ambition thing, it you know, how much is too much? I think that implies the false, you know, the fixed pie fallacy, but.
Yeah, and it applies, exactly. I think the thing, one of the themes I like to talk about and sort of put in people's heads is how hard it is for these basic assumptions to die. That, you know, people get these assumptions drilled into them so deeply, they're so widely accepted that people, you know, it's been probably 500 years since people should have figured this out, but people still have these concepts rattling around in their heads. And one of those is this idea, I think it's basically, you know, it's definitely 200 years since people should have figured out the fixed pie fallacy. The idea that if I get wealthy, it doesn't come by taking something from it. It doesn't have to come from taking something from somebody else. It could be that we're all better off, and I'm, you know, maybe, you know, because I started the right business, I'm better, I benefited way more than other people. But we have a system where everybody got better off because we had more stuff that was produced. But it comes from, you know, you have to have the idea that stuff is produced, right? That and not only that stuff is produced, but that more stuff is produced, that you can make progress, that you can come up with, oh, I came up with a new widget, a new gadget, a new tool, and now we can produce more stuff than we could before. And so that idea that the technological advances can happen and the total production of wealth can increase, that the pie can be growing so that the guy who's super ambitious at creating a new business and creating new ideas and producing new things is not gaining that at the expense of somebody else. He's creating that by producing so much more value that other people benefit, but he benefits more, right? So, but that growth mentality is one of the big things that we are missing today. I've got a little quick little, if you have time for me to do a 2-minute rant on an odd little example of that. Something I've been thinking about, I want to do a little more research and write about this. But one thing that I was thinking about is, you know, in this politically correct age, in the age of wokeness, we have all these battles about what's going on in the elite universities, what's going on at Harvard, and what's going on at Yale. And a lot of this stuff is about this intense competition for, you know, positions and status at these elite universities. Now, part of the reason we obsess over these, you know, status battles at elite universities is who populates the elite media? Well, a bunch of them and the elite of politics. Well, a bunch of them are guys who graduated from these elite universities. So, you know, what are Harvard's admissions policies like looms large in their brains, because that was them 20 years earlier, right? Trying to get into Harvard so they could become one of these elites. So partly it's this sort of weird inside baseball parochialism of that. But the other reason for it is this. And somebody pointed this out to me a while back, and I don't know where I read it, but I kind of didn't think about it that much, but it's been coming back in my mind, which is the U.S. population is like three times what it was in the early 20th century, right? We're 340 million people now. We're 100 million people not that long ago. Harvard still admits roughly the same number of students, right? So what you have is this, you know, and has roughly the same number of professors, that a lot of these elite universities have not grown even while the country gets three times bigger, and also while the whole educational system and the economic system becomes much more internationalized. So you have all these students from China and what have and Europe and all these other countries trying to get into Harvard. And so it creates this tremendous competition. This is hugely intensive. And also, by the way, most people are better educated. You know, in most more people graduate from high school than they used to. More people are capable of going on to college. So you have this enormous increase in the supply of people who could potentially be applying to these elite institutions. But they've kept the number of spots, the number of places at Harvard, artificially kept it, you know, they've deliberately kept it fixed. Now you can see some of the you know, incentives that they have. It's like, oh, we keep it fixed, so our prestige goes up even higher because we're so much rarer. But you also see why this, it comes from a shortage, it comes from and feeds into this shortage mentality of, oh, there's, you know, X number of students who get admitted to Harvard every year, and, you know, it'll never change, it'll never grow, there'll never be more spots, more chances to get into this elite institutions and become one of the top people. And even as the society gets so much bigger and so much better educated, that there ought to be way more people who are the same quality of to be teachers there, way more people who ought to be the same quality to be students there, right? So it's just how this stagnation mentality, this fixed pie mentality gets so deeply into all of our institutions and all of our assumptions about everything works, and then produces these weird, you know, dog-eat-dog, vicious level of competition. Because, well, if you admit black, there's a big scandal now, is if you admit black students into Harvard, basically the only way to do that is you have to stack the decks so the Asians can't get in. And Harvard is basically caught doing this. They've caught basically creating a system which would intentionally exclude Asian students. So they're all out there, you know, famously working very hard and getting high scores on their tests and doing all these amazing things, and they can't get into the elite institutions. Because they said, well, if we let another group in, we can't let you in. And it's that shortage mentality, that the idea that we're all in competition over a fixed, in effect, not only a fixed pie, but one that gets smaller and smaller compared to the population. So it shows how deeply that fixed pie shortage mentality has gotten into people's brains and permeates all the institutions and how they're created.
Good stuff. David, did you want to say something?
No, I'm...
Okay.
Sorry, I'm...
That's all right.
Okay, I'm still here. But no, thanks. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Scott.
Okay.
I'm interested in whoever else wants to pose a question.
Yeah, some of this seems to go back to, Rand's essay, The Establishing of an Establishment, because... So much, it's like the people in the elites, they want there to be a small, you know, group, no matter how many people that are just, you have to have gone to those schools to, you know, really rise high in, elite government status. I mean, Rand also used the term the aristocracy of pull. And so I think, you know, part of the reason it's not growing is the people that benefit from having that don't want the club to be much larger. Doctors do the same thing.
Well, yeah, and what I want to point out with this is why this Genghis Khan issue resonates so much with all these other different issues, is they're wrong about that. They're wrong, actually, factually wrong, that they are somehow better off by restricting other people from having these things. You know, they come so much from that stagnation mentality, that fixed pie mentality, that they actually, I mean, this is where Genghis Khan must have come from. Like I said, he had a rough childhood. He had a childhood where it was kill or be kill, and he created a system that was largely based on that. I mean, the one innovation he actually had was, let's not kill each other. Let's not kill our fellow Mongols. Let's go out and kill other people. But so I suppose you can say that's progress. But he had that sort of kill or be killed mentality. And so had this idea that the best way forward is I become powerful and conquer everybody else. And I think that's similar sort of thing that happens in a lot of things today, is if people think, well, we would be better off, you know, we, the elite, would be better off if we restrict everything and make sure there are fewer people who are able to be in the elite. Well, you're actually not better off that way. You know, if there were more doctors, we would all be better off. If there were more people who got a really high quality education, and good contacts and the ability and sort of entree into the institutions, we would actually have more people going out, creating more stuff, starting more businesses. We would actually all be better off. But again, because people look at it as this zero sum thing, that, you know, there's only a fixed number of positions, and if I don't get them, somebody else, and if somebody else gets one, then I'm out in the cold, because they have that shortage mentality so deeply buried in their psyche. That's why we get these weird situations where, you know, actually we'd be way better off with more people having access to an elite education, so that, you know, if the elite education is any good, if it is of any actual value, they'd be able to go out and do more and create more, and we'd all be better off. But people get, like I said, that's that it took thousands of years to get to the point of having this idea of enlightened self-interest and as the basis of a society. And then to get to the point where we actually had an example of the Industrial Revolution, of that kind of society leading to enormous progress and growth so that everybody's better off. And it takes so long for people to get that around their heads and to understand that and to be able to accept that as, you know, on a historical scale, this is a relatively new phenomenon that we've proved that this can happen. And it takes people, you know, it takes a culture so long that people rebel against it in various ways. It takes a culture so long to get that, actually to grasp those ideas and to be able to internalize them and accept them as normal.
I like those points.
I could add maybe one thing here. Going back again, just gone for a minute. One of his offsetting, one of the small things that offset his viciousness is he, as I understand it, he seemed to have a sense of merit, and he hired people, generals and engineers and so forth, who could actually produce. And he, somewhat regardless, as he conquered more countries, took on people from different cultures who were had merit. And that's one of the things, again, don't hold me to this, but my understanding is that that's part of what made him successful. But bringing that forward to the present day, and what you're saying about the elite institutions, Rob, you know, you're absolutely right about the, I mean, we've all read about what parents, some parents do to get their kids into Harvard or Yale or Princeton or whatever. But think of the really great achievers of our era, like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, the Microsoft guy,
Bill Gates dropped out.
He dropped out of Harvard. Peter Thiel was actually offering money to people to drop out of college for a while. And I mean, these guys, they did not count on their elite education if they even had it. I'm not sure about the others, but Gates was at Harvard anyway. But and left. They were not counting on their elite education. They were counting on their merit and their, and look what they've done. They did it in the few parts of the economy that are still relatively free. But it's, you know, it's just, I keep waiting, and I'm not the only one who say for people to say, wait a minute, you don't need to go to Harvard to do great work and be successful. We should have, you know, there's still a level of meritocracy. I don't like that word, but of merit, of the merit principle.
Yeah. Also, a lot of things that happens with places like Harvard is they often have very successful alumni, but it's partly because they have selection effects, right? They select only people who are top achievers by the time they're 17 or 18 years old. And so these are people who are, I mean, sort of the argument against higher education is these are people who are going to be successful no matter what. They could have gone to, you know, they could have gone to community college and still been successful because they're so driven and they're so hard. They're so hardworking. They're so intelligent. They're so hardworking. They're so driven that, you know, no matter what circumstances you put them in, they would have done something.
Great. Well, that's Lawrence. I'm sorry we're not going to get a chance. I really enjoyed this subject. Tomorrow at 5 p.m. on the Atlas Society, our continuing series of Scholars Asking Scholars will feature Richard Salzman interviewing Jason Hill. Should be a good episode. Thursday, back here on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, will be with TAS founder David Kelly on What is Open Objectivism, one of my favorite topics. I like to say it's only for those not afraid. And then finally, Friday, Richard Salzman will be back here on Clubhouse at 5 p.m. Eastern with an Ask Me Anything on Objectivism. So we look forward to those. And everyone who participated today, thank you very much. And we'll see you this week.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care.